Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Anthony Brooks.
That is the magnificent Boston Symphony Orchestra performing Brahms' Third Symphony. They'll be playing it again as part of the BSO's upcoming season, which begins tomorrow night.
But the performance won't be led by venerable conductor James Levine. Instead, the equally venerable German maestro Kurt Mazur will be at the podium.
Frequent illness and injury forced Levine to step down as music director earlier this year. It was a major loss for the orchestra, and yet subscribers are abuzz about the upcoming season, since the BSO has lined up a glittering array of guest conductors.
Still, the 130-year-old institution finds itself in a state of flux. Whoever is ultimately picked to be the next music director will lead the BSO into uncharted territory, where popular tastes and long-term funding are as up in the air for classical music as they are for the rest of the music industry.
If not more so. So here to talk about it all on the eve of the BSO's 131st season is Managing Director Mark Volpe. Welcome back to Radio Boston, Mr. Volpe.
It's great to be here.
We're also joined today by Ted Kelly. He's the newly appointed chair of the BSO's Board of Trustees. Mr. Kelly was a longtime executive at the Liberty Mutual Group. In semi-retirement now, he still serves as chairman of the board there. Mr. Kelly, welcome to you.
Great to be here, Meg.
Also with us today is Richard Dyer. He's former chief music critic for the Boston Globe. In his retirement, Dyer has continued to write and teach about classical music. We should say some of this has included paid work for the BSO, but when it comes to the search for a music director in the very shrouded world of that search, he isn't an outsider observer like the rest of us, but a very well-informed one. Mr. Dyer, welcome to you.
Thanks.
I'd also like to tell classical music fans, or just music fans in general out there, we welcome your comments and questions for the leadership team here of the Boston Symphony Orchestra. Who do you think should be the next music director, and when would you like to see that person announced or appointed? Give us a call at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK with any of your questions about the future of classical music in Boston. So, Mr. Volpe, let me just start off with you and ask you about the way the BSO is kicking off this season. You're going to be opening with violinist Anna-Sophie Mutter performing and conducting all five of the Mozart violin concertos. The play conducting thing was common in Mozart's time, definitely not so common now. Is it somewhat symbolic to not have an actual conductor on stage for tomorrow night's performance?
I think you just provided my answer. We decided in a year without a music director that we wanted to have one of the great artists of our time, a force of nature, Anne-Sophie Mutter, who anybody who's a Letterman fan can turn on Letterman tonight and see her on CBS. But anyhow, she is one of the great Mozart supporters and certainly interpreters, and she wanted to do a cycle, and she's done this in Europe, and we thought instead of bringing in a conductor, which frankly would in the press and possibly in the public would be probably overread, because frankly Jim Levine was scheduled to conduct this concert, and when he decided because of all of the challenges with his health to leave the music directorship. He created a situation where we had to have some, you know, and we started.
It was already programmed,
and many of the great conductors, especially in September, October, are already fully booked, you know, and so rather than bring in, you know, a journeyman, you know, and that certainly the rest of the season is as you noted, filled with phenomenal conductors and interesting mix of generations. We decided to do something somewhat unique, and Anne-Sophie, the glamorous Anne-Sophie, will be on the podium, not only playing but also leading the orchestra.
And these are pieces of music she knows so well. I mean, her first recordings when she was a teenager were exactly
14.
These pieces. Richard Dyer, let me just ask you for your first thoughts on opening the 131st season with Mozart.
Well, what better way to open anything with some of the greatest music ever written, and with an orchestra that excels in this music? I think it was a very smart thing to do, not to put some conductor, no matter who it is, on the spot in a situation as tricky as an opening night. I think it also levels the playing field for the rest of the season.
How so?
Well, meaning that there was not an heir apparent that was being presented on opening night, or somebody that could be read as an heir apparent. Well, I don't think she wants to become a full-time conductor.
I actually had the wonderful opportunity of interviewing her a little earlier this week. Listeners can hear that interview on tomorrow's show, but I do want to give everyone a taste of the rehearsal we recorded, so let's listen. She plays, as we were watching her rehearse, was so magnetic. We were up in the first balcony. I found myself almost hanging over the side just to get closer to the music. So really marvelous. What are some of the other highlights that you're looking forward to this season?
Well, I think, you know, it's going to be an interesting year for conductors. And what we've done is we have some of the great masters, Kurt Mazur, who was already mentioned, Christoph Andacciani, Raphael Frubeck de Burgos, and certainly our beloved conductor of 40 years, entitled conductor Bernard Haitink, who closes the last 3 weeks of the season with three different Beethoven symphonies, and we end with Beethoven 9. So we start with Mozart, a nice series of Mozart violin concerti, and then we end with three Beethoven symphonies. So, and in between, we have multi-generations. We have some younger conductors, we have some middle-aged conductors, we have some conductors who have been in front of the orchestra, in front of the audience in Boston for 30, 40 years. We have conductors that are brand new to Boston. So we've tried to put together a mix where a good half of the season are really known entities that the orchestra is comfortable with, the audience is comfortable with, and then frankly, the remaining half of the season is filled with conductors who we don't necessarily have as tight a relationship with, and when whether one evolves or not, time will tell.
Mr. Kelly, I wonder if I might ask you something. There's a particular quotation I'd like to read to you, and the quotation goes like this. There are only a few Boston institutions that, by the mention of their name alone, define fundamental things about this great city in which we live. The Boston Symphony and Boston Pops Orchestras are at the top of that list. That was you who said that. So
totally unbiased.
Of course. But so I guess my question for you, Mr. Kelly, is the situation that the BSO finds itself in, this both challenge and opportunity that it currently faces in finding a new music director, what is that saying about the city that we live in and this cultural institution?
Well, I think as we enter the, as you said, the 131st season, it is a time of, I think, great optimism on everybody involved in the institution, the trustees, the overseers, obviously the management, and the players. When Jim left for health reasons, he had left his imprint on the orchestra. He had raised the performance level. It is now playing incredibly well. And in fact, the esprit de corps developed in the last week or two without having a music director. They're essentially building their own team, which is wonderful, for a wonderful opportunity for them. And the other thing, you may have listening to the music, the rehearsal there, you could detect the wonderful acoustics in the hall. Mm. So we have a great orchestra playing in the best acoustics in the world. And at a time, we will have our choice, I believe, of the type of conductor who the committee will decide that can lead it to the next level.
Mr. Dyer, do you feel the same optimism in this opportunity as Ted Kelly's sharing with us?
Obviously. The future is open-ended, and wonderful, wonderful things can happen. There's one thing that disturbs me in the wide range of public commentary on this issue is that people are saying, oh, we need somebody young, or we need somebody more experienced. and I think the issue of age is fundamentally irrelevant because it's really a question of quality and experience no matter what the age. I mean, if you look at the list of the Boston Symphony music directors going back really before 1920, every single one of them, from Pierre Montour through Koussevitzky through Munch, through, every one of them has been a major world figure. Mm-hmm. And they have been at various ages. Seiji, I think, was the youngest music director ever. He was 35. So I think what's significant here is that the world is full of quality, and that what needs to be found at this point is the other thing that goes along with it, which is chemistry.
Well, we are speaking with the leadership team of the Boston Symphony Orchestra on the eve of the opening of the 131st season of the BSO. My guests are Richard Dyer, he's former chief music critic of the Boston Globe, Mark Volpe, managing director of the BSO, and Ted Kelly, he's the newly appointed chair of the BSO's Board of Trustees. If you have a question for them, give us a call at 1-800-423-8255. Mr. Volpe, you just heard Richard Dyer mention that maybe age is not an issue, and I know, let me just put it out there amongst all of you, I know that you're not going to name names yet. I know that, so I want to acknowledge that. But on the other hand, there are some names that have been wafting through the world of classical music here in Boston of possibilities. So I just want to ask you your thoughts about what each of them may represent. So the first of them is a young one. He's 30-year-old Venezuelan conductor Gustavo Dudamel, a.k.a. The Dude, which makes me like him because he's got that nickname. But he's drawn comparisons to a young Leonard Bernstein for his ability to really reach out to a mass audience. So we've got a clip here of Dudamel and an interview he did on the Canadian Broadcasting Company program Q.
Do you like all the attention that you personally get?
I think it's important for classical music because, of course, all music is important. We are only one, pop music, classical music, folk music. But, always classical music has been like for a little group of the society. And if we have the chance to give the attention to the classical music, it's great.
So that's Gustavo Dudamel. Richard Dyer earlier said that age isn't an issue, but is someone like Dudamel too young, Mark Volpe?
Well, recognize the Boston Symphony was the second orchestra in North America to invite Dudamel to its podium, and we had him at Tanglewood several years ago. I think what's interesting about Dudamel, beyond being a great young talent, and certainly the Bernstein comparisons are made, I would be remiss if I didn't note, Bernstein was one of the great composers. Mm-hmm. I think everyone knows West Side Story and certainly Candide and a few other pieces, so it's not an entirely fair comparison to Gustavo. But one of the things I would note about Gustavo that I think is worthy of broader attention is he comes out of a program in Caracas, where it's basically not even a cultural program, it's a social program where they go into the ghettos and they bring them together and put together youth orchestras throughout the country, throughout Venezuela, but with a large concentration in Caracas, and there are a quarter of a million kids. And when that investment, and there was one a gentleman named Abreu who put together this program over, I think, 35 years, over five different governments. And so when you see that kind of investment, and you that's what produces a Dudamel. And frankly, it's not necessarily just producing Dudamel. It's producing the entire middle class of mm-hmm. people who are going throughout the world. And so I think it's a great story far beyond the musical dimension.
I'm going to be maybe the irritating host and say, in that answer, I didn't hear a no. Let's take a couple calls. Elizabeth is calling from Barnstable. You're on the air, Elizabeth.
Hi. I'm glad because I couldn't remember Dudamel's name, and he was one of my suggestions as the next conductor, and sadly I couldn't hear what you were saying about him because I was talking to the screener. But anyway, he's one who I think would be fabulous, and I also like Alan Gilbert. I think he's young, and he's... But he's not so radical that he would rock the boat in Boston.
Elizabeth, thank you so much for your call. Gentlemen, your thoughts on Alan Gilbert, and for those of us who don't know who he is.
He has another job at the moment, which is as music director of the New York Philharmonic.
He was hired by his mother, who actually plays in the New York Philharmonic.
Yes, his father also played in the New York Philharmonic. He was a student at Harvard, so he knows the Boston scene very well.
But don't most of the highest profile quality conductors that you want, they all have other jobs?
Well, let me say one of the things, he will be coming back, because I think his 25th anniversary class at Harvard is just upcoming, and so he'll be on the podium of the Boston Pops. I think one of the things people don't necessarily realize is in the 50s, everything was here. I mean, Marshall had not rebuilt Europe, and of course MacArthur hadn't done what he ended up doing in Japan, and so, but with the advent of the 747, most of these conductors of the level that Richard noted that have been on the podium of the Boston Symphony, they're covering now not one continent, not two continents, but four or five continents, uh-huh. including Australia. So in all likelihood, whoever succeeds Jim will have another relationship, but I think our bias, and I don't want to speak for the committee, but is Boston has to be the priority.
Let me take another call. Stephen is calling from Cambridge. You're on the air, Stephen.
Hi, I really enjoy, you know, a great deal. First, I have to say I really enjoy a great deal of the BSO's programming, and it clearly is one of the most sort of exceptional symphonies in the country. And I think I have to say I'm in light of the way the kind of administration and the PR people dealt with the sort of closing years of the, you know, which ended up being really disappointing, James Iovine tenure. I'm wondering if the orchestra feels really any sort of at least civic obligation to sort of re-ingratiate itself to the public. I know the New York Philharmonic on occasion gives free concerts, and it just seems like, I don't know, you know, the BSO is the most affluent orchestra in the, US, in the United States, and
Stephen,
I really don't feel...
Thank you for your call. I'm sorry to interrupt, but I do want to give a chance to Ted Kelly to maybe provide an answer to your question.
Well, first of all, Stephen, thanks for the call. I do quibble with one of the leading orchestras in the U.S. I think, in fact, it is arguably one of the top three in the world and probably the top in the world. Yes, it was a very, very difficult period with Jim. I think we had to handle a true talent, one of the great talents in music, appropriately, give him the Jim, give it everything he had. The orchestra, both as players and as an institution, responded and supported them as long as they could. Unfortunately, it came to an end, but the orchestra is in great shape. And we're seeing an uptick in tickets as people are excited about it. Mark and Tony Fogg have put together a program for the next year that is just remarkable. And that's how we ingratiate ourselves. If we have to, we play great music to appreciative audiences. That's our target.
On that note, we're kind of approaching where we need to wrap up, but I did want to ask you all in the brief time that we have left that, you know, when James Iovine came to the BSO, he really was, a force to rejuvenating the energy and the sound of the orchestra. And when you look at the arts across Boston, there's been a wholesale rejuvenation, let's say, down the road at the MFA with their new collections and their new wings. Diane Paulus is doing really amazing mm-hmm. things at the ART. The existence of a brand new ICA. We're seeing lots of action and energy here. And you can make an argument that the BSO led the way on that. So I'm wondering if you look at this opportunity of trying to find someone to replace Master Iovine, how do you think the BSO can keep up that momentum?
It's one by playing great concerts, and I would note your prior caller. I mean, the orchestra has probably 20-25 chamber groups going out into the community playing free concerts, and certainly we play this concert with the Boston Pops on July 4th. We try to keep it quiet, but somehow 500,000 people find out about it and show up on the banks of the Charles River. I think what we need to do in the future is basically commit to the highest level of artistic excellence and community engagement. And if we continue doing that, we're going to be in great shape.
And additionally, it would be remiss if I didn't point out the educational outreach of mm-hmm. the orchestra. They reach into the schools, and one particular school, they are the music program, and that is how we build the arts in the city, by reaching out into the community.
Ted Kelly, he's the newly appointed chair of the BSO's Board of Trustees. Mark Volpe is managing director of the Boston Symphony Orchestra, and Richard Dyer, former chief music critic from the Boston Globe. Thank you all so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
We're going to go out on a little music from Anna-Sophie Mutter. She is, of course, going to be performing and conducting Mozart's 3rd and 5th violin concertos tomorrow night at the opening of the BSO's 131st season. There's more to come. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty with Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston.